Part 2, Section A. The court offers flimsy and transparent justifications for upholding a nationwide ban on intact DNA, sans any exception to safeguard a woman's health. Today's ruling, the court declares, advances a premise central to Casey's conclusion, i.e., the government's legitimate and substantial interest in preserving and promoting fetal life. We must determine whether the act furthers the legitimate interest of the government in protecting the life of the fetus that may become a child. But the act scarcely furthers that interest. The law saves not a single fetus from destruction, for it targets only a method of performing abortion. And surely the statute was not designed to protect the lives or health of pregnant women. In short, the court upholds a law that, while doing nothing to preserve fetal life, bars a woman from choosing intact DNA, although her doctor reasonably believes that procedure will best protect her. As another reason for upholding the ban, the court emphasizes that the act does not proscribe the non-intact DNA procedure. But why not, one might ask? Non-intact DNA could equally be characterized as brutal, involving, as it does, tearing a fetus apart and ripping off its limbs. The notion that either of these two equally gruesome procedures is more akin to infanticide than the other, or that the state furthers any legitimate interest by banning one but not the other, is simply irrational. Delivery of an intact, albeit non-viable, fetus warrants special condemnation, the court maintains, because a fetus that is not dismembered resembles an infant. But so too does a fetus delivered intact after it is terminated by injection a day or two before the surgical evacuation, or a fetus delivered through medical induction or cesarean. Yet the availability of those procedures, along with DNA by dismemberment, the court says, saves the ban on intact DNA from a declaration of unconstitutionality. Never mind that the procedures deemed acceptable might put a woman's health at greater risk. Ultimately, the court admits that moral concerns are at work, concerns that could yield prohibitions on any abortion. Notably, the concerns expressed are untethered to any ground genuinely serving the government's interest in preserving life. By allowing such concerns to carry the day and case, overriding fundamental rights, the court dishonors our precedent. Some of us as individuals find abortion offensive to our most basic principles of morality, but that cannot control our decision. Our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. Revealing in this regard, the court invokes an anti-abortion shibboleth for which it concededly has no reliable evidence. Women who have abortions come to regret their choices and consequently suffer from severe depression and loss of esteem. Because of women's fragile emotional state and because of the bond of love the mother has for her child, the court worries, doctors may withhold information about the nature of the intact DNA procedure. The solution the court approves, then, is not to require doctors to inform women accurately and adequately of the different procedures and their attendant risks. States are free to enact laws to provide a reasonable framework for a woman to make a decision that has such a profound and lasting meaning. Instead, the court deprives women of the right to make an autonomous choice, even at the expense of their safety. This way of thinking reflects ancient notions about women's place in the family and under the Constitution, ideas that have long since been discredited. Though today's majority may regard women's feelings on the matter as self-evident, this court has repeatedly confirmed that the destiny of women must be shaped on her own conception of her spiritual imperatives and her place in society. Means chosen by the state to further the interest in potential life must be calculated to inform the woman's free choice, not hinder it. Section B. In cases on a woman's liberty to determine whether to continue her pregnancy, this court has identified viability as a critical consideration. There is no line more workable than viability, the court explained in Casey, for viability is the time at which there is a realistic possibility of maintaining and nourishing a life outside the womb, so that the independent existence of the second life can, in reason and all fairness, be the subject of state protection that now overrides the rights of the woman. In some broad sense, it might be said that a woman who fails to act before viability has consented to the state's intervention on behalf of the developing child. Today, the court blurs that line, maintaining that the act legitimately applies both pre-viability and post-viability because a fetus is a living organism while within the womb, whether or not it is viable outside the womb. Instead of drawing the line at viability, the court refers to Congress's purpose to differentiate abortion and infanticide based not on whether a fetus can survive outside the womb, but on where a fetus is anatomically located when a particular procedure is performed. One wonders how long a line that saves no fetus from destruction will hold in the face of the court's moral concerns. The court's hostility to the right Roe and Casey secured is not concealed. Throughout, the opinion refers to obstetrician gynecologists and surgeons who perform abortions not by the titles of their medical specialties, but by the pejorative label abortion doctor. A fetus is described as an unborn child and as a baby. Second trimester previability abortions are referred to as late term. And the reasoned medical judgments of highly trained doctors are dismissed as preferences motivated by mere convenience. Instead of the heightened scrutiny we have previously applied, the court determines that a rational ground is enough to uphold the act. And most troubling, Casey's principles confirming the continuing vitality of the essential holding of Roe are merely assumed for the moment, rather than retained or reaffirmed. Part 3, Section A. The court further confuses our jurisprudence when it declares that facial attacks are not permissible in these circumstances, i.e., where medical uncertainty exists. This holding is perplexing given that in materially identical circumstances we held that a statute lacking a health exception was unconstitutional on its face. Virtually all of the abortion cases reaching the Supreme Court since Roe v. Wade have involved facial attacks on state statutes, and the court, whether accepting or rejecting the challenges on the merits, has typically accepted this framing of the question presented. Without attempting to distinguish Stenberg and earlier decisions, the majority asserts that the act survives review because respondents have not shown that the ban on intact DNE would be unconstitutional in a large fraction of relevant cases. But Casey makes clear that in determining whether any restriction poses an undue burden on a large fraction of women, the relevant class is not all women, nor all pregnant women, nor even all women seeking abortions. Rather, a provision restricting access to abortion must be judged by reference to those women for whom it is an actual rather than an irrelevant restriction. Thus, the absence of the health exception burdens all women for whom it is relevant, women who, in the judgment of their doctors, require an intact DNE because other procedures would place their health at risk. It makes no sense to conclude that this facial challenge fails because respondents have not shown that a health exception is necessary for a large fraction of second trimester abortions, including those for which a health exception is unnecessary. The very purpose of a health exception is to protect women in exceptional cases. Section B. If there is anything at all redemptive to be said of today's opinion, it is that the court is not willing to foreclose entirely a constitutional challenge to the act. The act is open, the court states, to a proper as-applied challenge in a discrete case. But the court offers no clue on what a proper lawsuit might look like, nor does the court explain why injunctions ordered by the district courts should not remain in place, trimmed only to exclude instances in which another procedure would safeguard a woman's health at least equally well. Surely the court cannot mean that no suit may be brought until a woman's health is immediately jeopardized by the ban on intact DNA. A woman suffering from medical complications needs access to the medical procedure at once and cannot wait for the judicial process to unfold. The court appears then to contemplate another lawsuit by the initiators of the instant actions. In such a second round, the court suggests, the challengers could succeed upon demonstrating that in discrete and well-defined instances a particular condition has or is likely to occur in which the procedure prohibited by the Act must be used. One may anticipate that such a pre-enforcement challenge will be mounted swiftly to ward off serious, sometimes irremediable harm to women whose health would be endangered by the intact D&E prohibition. The court envisions that in an as-applied challenge, the nature of the medical risk can be better quantified and balanced. But it should not escape notice that the record already includes hundreds and hundreds of pages of testimony identifying discrete and well-defined instances in which recourse to an intact D&E would better protect the health of women with particular conditions. Record evidence also documents that medical exigencies, unpredictable in advance, may indicate to a well-trained doctor that intact D&E is the safest procedure. In light of this evidence, our unanimous decision just 1 year ago in IOTE counsels against reversal. The court's allowance only of an as-applied challenge in a discrete case jeopardizes women's health and places doctors in an untenable position. Even if courts were able to carve out exceptions through piecemeal litigation for discrete and well-defined instances, women whose circumstances have not been anticipated by prior litigation could well be left unprotected. In treating those women, physicians would risk criminal prosecution, conviction, and imprisonment if they exercised their best judgment as to the safest medical procedure for their patients. The court is thus gravely mistaken to conclude that narrow as-applied challenges are the proper manner to protect the health of the woman. Part 4. As the court wrote in Casey, overruling Roe's central holding would not only reach an unjustifiable result under principles of stare decisis, but would seriously weaken the court's capacity to exercise the judicial power and to function as the Supreme Court of a nation dedicated to the rule of law. The very concept of the rule of law underlying our own Constitution requires such continuity over time that a respect for precedent is by definition indispensable. To overrule under fire in the absence of the most compelling reason to re-examine a watershed decision would subvert the court's legitimacy beyond any serious question. Though today's opinion does not go so far as to discard Roe or Casey, the court, differently composed than it was when we last considered a restrictive abortion regulation, is hardly faithful to our earlier indications of the rule of law and the principles of stare decisis. Congress imposed a ban despite our clear prior holdings that the state cannot proscribe an abortion procedure when its use is necessary to protect a woman's health. Although Congress's findings could not withstand the crucible of trial, the court defers to the legislative override of our Constitution-based rulings. A decision so at odds with our jurisprudence should not have staying power. In sum, the notion that the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act furthers any legitimate governmental interest is quite simply irrational. The court's defense of the statute provides no saving explanation. In candor, the act and the court's defense of it cannot be understood as anything other than an effort to chip away at a right declared again and again by this court, and with increasing comprehension of its centrality to women's lives. When a statute burdens constitutional rights, and all that can be said on its behalf is that it is the vehicle that legislators have chosen for expressing their hostility to those rights, the burden is undue. For the reasons stated, I dissent from the court's disposition and would affirm the judgments before us for review.